Hi again, everybody, and welcome to the Amerinds Podcast, episode 109. It's Friday, August 22nd, 2008. Today's topic is marriage equality, not weddings, which is why I interrupted that lovely music at the start. And the beginning point for my thinking in all of this was a link that was provided to me by Roger Green in a comment. And I'll be talking about that a bit more later. But first, I thought I would share some of my thoughts about the whole topic of marriage equality. Now, I'm a firm believer in marriage equality, partly because I'm a firm believer in equality. However, I don't think that marriage or even coupling is for everyone, and those who want to remain single shouldn't face discrimination because of that, which is probably a subject in itself, but I'll come back to that a little bit later on. Now, the point of this discussion is that if there is to be marriage, then it must be provided to same-sex couples as well as heterosexual couples. Now, as we all know, the most common objections to same-sex marriage are religious-based. Sometimes people will talk about history or tradition, but when it really comes down to it, they're just talking about religion. And the single most common objection, at least that I've heard, is that marriage is for procreation and the raising of children. And if that were true, then heterosexuals who don't have children, either because they don't want them or because they can't have them for whatever reason, shouldn't be allowed to marry. Now, some of the religionists counter that childless heterosexual married couples still provide support to those heteromarried couples who do have children because they reinforce the norm of one man married to one woman to raise children. But it seems to me that this is mixing apples and oranges, because while childless hetero couples may reinforce the norm of hetero marriage generally, it could also be argued that polygamous marriages reinforce the notion of child rearing within the context of heterosexual marriage. And of course, they never use that argument. Now, this should be bloody obvious, but child rearing and marriage are not necessarily related. Many single parents do a fine job of raising children, and many heterosexual married couples do a terrible job. And similarly, many gay male or lesbian couples do a fantastic job of raising children. And to me, that all suggests that some people make great parents and others should never be parents. And people, not sexualities, are parents, and people raise children. Another argument is that traditional heterosexual marriage is the base on which civilization is built, and that's actually true. But the same thing was once said of slavery and any number of other behaviors and practices that we now find abhorrent. Society's interest, it seems to me, is in having stable, loving homes. These provide the best places to raise children, as studies have shown, and they also provide for the happiness of people, and that makes those people better and more productive citizens. However, obviously, the sexuality of the people in the partnership is not relevant to either case, either situation, because studies have also demonstrated clearly that a loving same-sex couple can be just as successful as parents as a loving heterosexual couple. But couples themselves have an interest in this instability in their lives too, and part of the reason for marriage is that it establishes kinship between the couple, providing automatic inheritance of property, well, and of course the welfare of children. Now, marriage provides this automatic, unquestioned, and virtually incontestable right between partners. Without marriage, couples have to spend hundreds or even thousands of dollars on lawyers and legal filing fees to draw up documents that don't provide even a fraction of the protection that marriage does, and they can be struck down by judges, and they often are. So, if marriage is not exclusively about children, and it isn't, and if society has a vested interest in stable, happy homes, and I think it does, then not only is there no logical argument against same-sex marriage, there's actually strong reasons to support it. But what about that word? What if same-sex couples are given something else, like civil unions? Now, I've got two minds about this. First, I think that anytime governments set up separate but equal institutions, they end up enshrining separate and unequal. The very idea, to me, offends every concept of liberty, justice, equality, fairness, all of those sorts of things. However, what's most important are the legal rights and privileges that come with marriage. And if civil unions provide all of the same legal rights, privileges of marriage, then I can live with separate but equal. Now, in the U.S., that would have to include federal, state, and local taxes and all other benefits given to married couples, such as immigration rights. Now, in New Zealand, civil unions are equal to marriage in every way that I'm aware of, except for one, which is adoption, as I've discussed previously. Now, marriage, despite its non-religious core, clearly has religious roots and overtones, and civil unions do not. So for me, the larger issue in this whole debate is, should government be in the business of managing a religious institution at all? And I say they shouldn't. I believe that all couples, same-sex and opposite-sex, should be required to get a civil union in order to get the rights and privileges now given to married people. This should be the only thing that any level of government recognizes. Now, various religions can then go on and perform non-legal marriages, and obviously they'd argue loudly about who's really married, just as Christians, for example, now argue about who's really saved. But just as Christian salvation is none of the government's business, neither should they be getting into marriage and all this religious baggage. It seems to me that that doesn't serve the interests of either government or religion. But what's left unexamined in this is the larger question, I touched on it a little bit earlier, I suppose, of whether government has any business extending any benefits to couples at all. Should they just be treated as individuals? Now, things are a bit different in New Zealand. Here, there's legal recognition given to couples and marriage only to opposite-sex couples. But there are few, if any, benefits given to couples. All taxpayers file tax returns as individuals, for example. Being a couple enters into it only in terms of things like benefits, welfare, and in legal cases where one spouse can't usually be compelled to testify against the other spouse, which is, of course, in accordance with common law that goes back centuries. But any couple in a relationship of 3 or more years is automatically covered by what's called the Relationship Property Act. And that means that they automatically own all their property 50-50 without doing anything. So in the event the relationship ends, for whatever reason, the partners are both protected, whether or not they have an officially recognized relationship. And generally speaking, this is called a de facto relationship, and it's similar in some ways to what other jurisdictions call a common law marriage. And that has always been open to all people, regardless of sexual orientation. Same-sex couples, opposite-sex couples, doesn't matter. They're automatically covered after 3 years, unless in advance they write out a contract specifically opting out, which they can do. But once you're in the relationship, you can't do that. And if you do draw up the contract, both parties have to have their own attorneys. So that's to prevent one partner from forcing the other into signing a contract. I suppose it's a bit like a prenuptial agreement, really. So, there in New Zealand, there's no compelling reason for people to get married, yet a majority of hetero couples eventually do marry, even without the government providing special benefits to married couples. So it seems to me that in New Zealand, they've sort of struck this balance between the traditional, government sanction for a marriage, and yet they haven't piled all of these benefits on top of that. And, I mean, part of it, I actually think that the reason a lot of this has evolved the way it has is because New Zealand has one of the most streamlined and transparent tax regimes of any country in the world, or at least in the OECD, probably the entire world. And so that led them to want to have a simple, straightforward tax structure that doesn't involve a lot of deductions for marriage or for mortgages or taxes, property rates, we call them, or what have you. And I think that's probably got more to do with it than anything. But New Zealand is also a very egalitarian society and doesn't look too kindly on people who try to place others, one group of people, above other groups of people. And I think that actually has something to do with it as well. But, as I said before, the main starting point of this was a link that was provided to me by Roger. And what it is, some of you may have seen references to this on Joe My God. That's where I first saw it. But it is a blogger, I suppose you call him, with over at Mormon Times. Now, of course, the Mormons are rabidly anti-gay marriage. And they're planning on putting, I think it's 1 million signs on California lawns against this. They're, what do they call them, temples, I think, have all been ordered to campaign in support of banning gay marriage. And they're spending millions of dollars of their money on this effort. So it's not surprising that you'd have a Mormon who's rabidly against gay marriage. And the Mormon Times is not associated directly with the Mormon Church, but I mean, they all talk to each other, don't they? So this was one of the most bizarre things I've ever read. And I mean, I've looked at some of the truly far out there sites on the internet for right-wing people. And you see the you see really bad things there as well. But they're at least semi-mainstream, I suppose. This, however, was not. And I'm not going to provide a link to it, in case you're interested, because I just have a policy that I never provide links to WingNet sites. I just won't do that. You can go find it yourself if you want, or you can find Roger's comment and click on the link. And I've forgotten which episode that was, but it can't be too hard to find. It's got to be one of the more recent ones. I should have looked that up. I'm sorry. If you really want to see it, but I won't provide a link to it. But it's the guy who wrote it is called Orson Scott Card. I've never heard of him before. Apparently he's written some fantasy novels or something. Mind you, I thought the Mormon Church was a fantasy, but that's a whole other, that's my own prejudice. And it is truly bizarre. And so what I did is I actually read the whole damn thing, and I highlighted certain parts where I thought that he was being the most bizarre. And I just put in my own little comments. And I'm not going to post this anywhere either. But I thought what I would do is just read those sections. I'm not going to read the entire post. I think it's, I don't know if it's a column or a blog or what you call this thing. But I'm just going to read those parts that I thought were, and just hang on, shift in my chair. I'm just going to read the parts that I think were the most outrageous, or the things where I thought, you know, needed some counterbalance. And part of the reason I'm going over this is because these are, many of these things are the things that the far right says all the time. And I think it's kind of useful to hear some of their arguments just put into proper context and frankly demolished. So let's begin. First thing is these are statements that he makes. And the title is State Job is Not to Redefine Marriage. And of course, the idea that any government is redefining marriage is exactly the main point. It's the way that the right wing is framing this whole debate, when of course it has nothing to do with redefining marriage. It has to do with redefining the rights and privileges of marriage, which is an entirely different issue. Nobody's redefining marriage. Marriage is a contract between two individuals. And all that's being questioned here is whether or not heterosexuals have an exclusive right to those rights or not. So, his first statement that I'm challenging. Quote, "These judges are making new law without any democratic process. In fact, their decisions are striking down laws enacted by majority vote." Now, judges, I'm going to read my responses directly as well. "Judges are part of the democratic process. Their job is to ensure that laws passed are consistent with relevant constitutions, in this case, California's. Sooner or later, everyone will disagree with a court ruling, which in itself suggests a balance. Pointless rhetoric like activist judges just proves that judges are getting it right because it's not used when the person agrees with a court ruling, even when it could equally be considered activist, like when the U.S. Supreme Court decided on the D.C. gun law. Putting aside questions about the legitimacy of that vote, talking about the California vote, majority vote isn't a sacred thing. Voters can get things very, very wrong. And it's up to the courts to sometimes protect people from their own excesses, just as they protect the people from the excesses of legislators. Their role is to ensure that the constitutions are upheld. It's also the duty of government to protect the minority from the tyranny of the majority." And that's an important thing. A lot of people talk in almost, if you'll forgive the expression, religious terms about the will of the people and majority rule, but it is not a sacred thing. Majority rule just means the number of people who can shout the loudest, essentially. And we all know that in terms of elections, that very often it's a minority of a minority who actually decides an issue. And the reason is that very often it is, if you're lucky, a bare majority of eligible voters who turn out to the polls. Very often it's a minority of eligible voters who turn out to the polls. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that 50% of eligible voters actually vote, and 25 and half of them plus one end up deciding an issue. It means you're talking about 25% of all eligible voters are dictating to the other 75% how things should be. And you cannot assume that the people who don't vote are happy with that. There are a number of reasons why people don't vote, and God knows there are lengthy studies about this subject. But it is not a safe bet that those who don't vote support the minority who managed to carry through an issue on a ballot. That's one thing. And the other thing is, as I said in my comment, that even voters can get things wrong. And sometimes courts have to intervene in order to keep things in accordance with, in this case, state constitution. And if people don't like what the state constitution says, then it's their job to amend the constitution so that it does say what they want. But you can't just expect courts to sit back and say, oh, this law you passed violates our constitution, but because you passed it, we'll just sit back and do nothing. That's not the way it works. The democratic system requires that judges go in there, strike down unconstitutional laws, and if the people don't like that, they go in and change the constitution. That's the way the process works. It doesn't make it that the judges are activists just because they're upholding the constitution. Now, a good example of that is, as I mentioned, the Supreme Court decision on the D.C. gun law. I think they got it completely wrong. And I certainly think it can be argued that the Supreme Court majority were being activist on that, creating new law where none had existed before. However, the rule of law is that when the court rules, that's that. And if I don't like that, I should organize to amend the Constitution to clarify what the Second Amendment means. Not that that's going to happen, but my point is still the same, that the court's role is to interpret the Constitution. Whether it's a state court or a federal court, it's the same thing. And people who don't like that have to use the democratic process, not sit and complain about activist judges. Right, let's go on to the next one. This one really pisses me off. He goes, remember how rapidly gay marriage has become a requirement, that's emphasis. When gay rights were being enforced by the courts back in the 70s and 80s, we were repeatedly told by all the proponents of gay rights that they would never attempt to legalize gay marriage. It took about 15 minutes for that promise to be broken. This is so far from the truth that the author is either ignorant of history or is lying for political reasons. In fact, courts had almost nothing to do with establishing gay rights in the 70s and 80s. Instead, it was state and local governments who were extending legal protections. Courts were involved mainly to uphold the laws and turn back legal attacks by fundamentalists. In fact, for many years, courts were the enemy of GLBT people. Bowers v. Hardwick was a 1986 decision that upheld the legality of state anti-sodomy laws, which was later overturned by Lawrence v. Texas in 2003. And of course, now that's under threat if McCain is elected president. But marriage equality was always on the agenda of the gay and lesbian activists. There is absolutely no way that anyone could seriously argue that it wasn't. However, it was never a priority until the issue was forced by extremist fundamentalists who sought to outlaw same-sex marriage because they correctly anticipated that courts would strike down anti-gay marriage bans as illegal. There was never, ever a promise not to pursue marriage equality. I know because I was an activist in the mid-80s to the mid-90s. I was there, and I was part of it. And I can say, without fear of contradiction or being proven wrong, that there's no such thing as a promise not to pursue legalized same-sex marriage. It's a myth. And I have actually seen these right-wingers drag up some pamphlet from somewhere or other where they said, oh, we don't want to pursue that. But that's absolute bullshit. I could probably find a pamphlet of theirs that calls for the gassing of gays. What's your point? I'm not saying that all Christians want to gas gays, although I think there are some who do. And certainly the majority of the gay and lesbian movement has always been for total social and legal equality, including marriage. So that's absolute bullshit. And what does this one refer to? Oh, and he goes on with the same thought. And you can guess how long it will now take before any group that speaks against gay marriage, being identical to marriage, will be attacked using the same tools that have been used against anti-abortion groups, RICO laws, for instance. Now, of course, RICO laws are racketeering laws, essentially. And I said, this is scaremongering nonsense. RICO laws apply to criminal conspiracy only. If the opponents of marriage equality aren't conspiring to commit criminal acts, they have nothing to worry about from RICO or any other law. And that is a point that has to be made again and again and again because they keep dragging this up. There's nothing in any law enacted or even possible that would curtail their free speech rights. They can say that gay marriage is wrong. They can say it's sinful. They can say that gay people are all going to hell if they want to. They're wrong, of course, but they can say that all they want to, and there's nothing that stops that. They cannot, however, plan to blow up a gay and lesbian community center because they don't like same-sex marriage. They cannot organize a campaign of hatred and intimidation against gay people or gay organizations because they don't like same-sex marriage. See what I'm saying? It has to do with their criminal intent, not their belief structure. They go on. Or he goes on, no matter how sexually attracted a man might be toward other men or a woman toward other women, and no matter how close the bonds of affection and friendship might be within same-sex couples, there is no act of court or Congress that can make these relationships the same as the coupling between a man and a woman. And dismissive nonsense. I assume this guy is a lifelong exclusive heterosexual. I take him at his word that he loves his wife. That he loves and is in love with his wife. I would never say of his relationship that it's, quote, bonds of affection and friendship, even though one hopes that they're there. What these religious extremists want is for people to believe a lie that same-sex love is impossible or, if it exists, that it's not as real as heterosexual love. Same-sex love can obviously be as deep and committed as opposite-sex love or as shallow. The point is, love is love is love. This is also why religious extremists focus on gay sex almost exclusively. They want people to believe that gay relationships are only about sex, because if the truth comes out that they're about love and commitment, then anyone can see that banning same-sex marriages makes no sense. Okay, now, this is an important point. Bear this in mind, because we're going to come back to this shortly. He goes on. There is no natural method by which two males or two females can create offspring in which both parents contribute genetically. This is not subject to legislation, let alone fashionable opinion. Human beings are part of a long mammalian tradition of heterosexuality. No parthenogenic test tube procedure can alter what we by nature are. No surgery, no hormone injections can change X to Y or make the distinction non-existent. No. Humans are part of heterosexual reproduction, not heterosexuality. Love and sex are not the same thing, remember? The rest of this argument is irrelevant, and it is, because what difference does it make whether or not scientists can create new human life without sexual reproduction? It's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with whether or not two people who love each other should be allowed to marry. It's a totally separate issue. Next. That many individuals suffer from sex role dysfunctions does not change the fact that only heterosexual mating can result in families where a father and mother collaborate in rearing children that share genetic contribution from both parents. This is not the only kind of family. Even among heterosexuals, there are varieties, with families blended in many different ways. So clearly sharing, quote, a genetic contribution is not a requirement for family. Sex role, in quotes, dysfunctions refers to the religious extremist antique male-dominated worldview in which women are secondary to the man. I already started touching on this a little bit, and I'm going to be coming back to that. Next, husbands need to have the whole society agree that when they marry, their wives are off limits to all other males. He has a right to trust that his wife's children would be his. Wives need to have the whole society agree that when they marry, their husband is off limits to all other females. All of his protection and earning power will be devoted to her and her children and will not be divided with other women and their children. The off-limits part does have historic roots. It refers to the necessity of the man's being sure that only his genetic material is passed on, and so that any children really are his. And of course, this has to do with property rights. All of his protection and earning power? What, like father knows best? And it really isn't a very old-fashioned viewpoint, because what he's really talking about is the father as the sole provider, which is not a reality for the vast majority of families these days, I'm afraid. Next, marriage to be worth preserving needs to mean not just something, but everything. Faithful sexual monogamy, persistence until death, male protection and providence for wife and children, female loyalty to children and husband, and parental discretion in child rearing. This is the core of the worldview. The man is the ruler and determiner of everything. Same-sex marriage challenges that male authority because the man cannot control how his genetic material will be passed on, or even if it will. It's all about power and control. And this is the essential gist of the whole argument. The basic extremist argument is that gay people provide a fundamental challenge to the male authority. And, I mean, it's often been said that the root of homophobia is misogyny, because the hatred that's directed towards gay men in particular is based on the fact that one of the men in a heterosexual viewpoint is taking on the role of a woman, which is why this guy talks about sex role dysfunction. But one of the men is taking on the role of a woman. And that is unforgivable for a man to give up his male power, his male status. And it is at the core of much of the far-right religious argument. He goes on. It gets better. Because when government is the enemy of marriage, then the people who are actually creating successful marriages have no choice but to change governments by whatever means necessary. By whatever means necessary? Does the Department of Homeland Security know about this threat? Sounds like sedition to me. Society gains no benefit whatsoever except from a momentary warm feeling about how fair and compassionate we are from renaming heterosexual liaisons and friendships as marriage. Again, this guy's dismissing the legitimacy of same-sex relationships. Again, he is either ignorant or lying for political gain, because he's again suggesting that same-sex relationships have no emotional validity, that they are empty, is essentially what he's saying. And frankly, that this whole thing, that's the thing that pissed me off the most, and I may come back to that. What these dictator judges do not seem to understand is that their authority extends only as far as people choose to obey them, and disobeying the law has consequences. Regardless of law, marriage has only one definition, and any government that attempts to change it is my mortal enemy. I will act to destroy that government and bring it down. Someone ring the FBI. He's made a direct terrorist threat against the United States and all lower levels of government. Somehow I doubt the Bush-Cheney regime will investigate, and a McCain regime certainly wouldn't, either. Now, if someone on the other side of this argument were to use similar language, the feds would be all over them. And I think that is one of the inherent problems of the Bush-Cheney regime, and that's that the right gets a free pass on everything, but if somebody on the center-left dares to challenge the Bush-Cheney regime, they're all over them. And I could list chapter and verse of where they've done that and under what circumstances, but quite frankly, I'm not going to bother. I think that guy, if ever there was an individual who deserved the term wingnut, it's him. He is absolutely crazy. And it is unusual to hear a wingnut making direct threats against the government of the United States or any of its individual states. But that's clearly what he did. And I, for one, don't think that that should be tolerated by anyone else on the right. But I have to say this, the silence has been pretty deafening on this. They certainly haven't risen to challenge him on any of it. Now, when I read it, there were a lot of things where I was rolling my eyes. And, of course, I put on my responses to certain parts of it that I thought were the most outrageous. But when he was talking about same-sex love as being affection and friendship, I will be very honest with you, my gut reaction is, fuck you, because he does not know what he's talking about. And I wouldn't, as I said in the comment thing, I would never presume to judge the validity of his relationship with his wife, assuming he's married, I assume he is. I would never deign to just say that it's only friendship or affection, although obviously one hopes they're there. So he has absolutely no right to judge my relationship or the relationship of any other gay or lesbian person. And he can disagree with me about marriage. He can hate me personally. I don't give a fuck. but he does not mess with me or my relationship or that of anyone I love, because I will stand nose to nose with him on that one. You thought I was going to say something worse, didn't you? Not me. Now, I only have one comment today, and it's a phone message, which I'm going to play right now.
Hey, Arthur. It's Apollonius from They Don't Know, also known as Peter from Atlanta, and I just wanted to call and say I finished listening to the episode where you played all the feedback about not changing the show, and because I was on vacation, I've got a bit backlogged, and I don't think I ever heard the episode where you were talking about planning to change the show. Or maybe I did, and it just, like, you know, didn't sink in. Either way, because I'm clever but not that wise, I think I'm going to recommend that you change the show completely. Make it about nothing but shoes. Okay, that's probably a very bad idea. But otherwise, I just wanted to call and say, I, like everyone else who was weighed off, very much appreciate your show for what it is, and you can do with it whatever the hell you want, because it's yours. That, and I'm really, really glad I don't have a packet shaping or a bandwidth cap, any type of internet provider that does that. And I think packet shaping is pretty much when your internet provider decides to only let certain types of packets through. So they'll, like, you know, let pictures through and let or let text through, but otherwise if they detect that it's just a massively long, like, file transfer, like an MP3 or a torrent, they tend to really clamp down on the speed of it. That's a way to discourage people from torrenting all the time or, like, you know, downloading movies, but the ISPs that do it tend to be big old dicks and not the good kind. So either way, I will talk to you later. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Peter. And after I listened to your message, I thought about it, and I thought, I have heard about that somewhere before, and as luck would have it, I read an article about it, I think it was this morning or something, and apparently it's becoming quite common in the U.S. to do that. And I also remember some time ago reading something about that starting to happen in Australia, which is, of course, where Scotty's from, and that's where this all started, because he was complaining about that. And as I recall, in Australia, it started with pressure from the studios who wanted to try to stop the illegal downloading of movies. And it may have been the record labels involved as well. I'm not really sure about that part, but certainly the movie studios. Now, typically that doesn't happen in New Zealand. However, we've always had data caps on our broadband. As I explained before, what that basically means is that once we've reached our data cap, we start getting charged per gigabyte for however much we spend over that. Now, our plan is for the highest data cap there is, which is very expensive. And so we get quite a lot in that. But, I mean, we use the internet quite a lot, too. And no, not for illegal downloading. I upload easily 40 megabytes a month just for work. And also, of course, there's all these podcasts, which are roughly 30, 40 megabytes each. And it all starts to add up over time. And, of course, I subscribe to lots of podcasts, which I download, and they're all 40-odd megabytes each. And it does all add up. Now, I did read in this article, it was through Yahoo News, I don't know, I've forgotten where it originally came from, that data caps are fairly new to the U.S., but it did mention that they are quite common in the rest of the world. And as I said, we've had them for a very long time. And I don't think they're going to go away. But what I do think is that as our telecoms market is being deregulated extensively, and as a matter of fact, we're about to switch over from the old monopoly to one of the competing companies. The local switch will be owned by the new company, and not new, but the company that we're switching to. And that should mean that they can offer much faster broadband, but they'll probably still have data caps. But as the market becomes more competitive, that could change. Now, I think a better solution would be to find some way of dealing with this issue once and for all without throttling back people who have legitimate uses of their internet service. Now, as it happens, and related to this, iTunes New Zealand has just recently launched movie rentals and sales, which of course has been available in the U.S. for quite a long time now. And I believe it was launched in Australia and New Zealand at the same time, which is interesting, because the iTunes launched in Australia something like 6 months or more before it launched in New Zealand. And so we in New Zealand had virtually no legal way to download music. And, of course, we had no way to legally download movies until now. But now we do. But I just thought it was kind of interesting, really. And that's really all I wanted to tell you about today. As I said, it was mostly about marriage equality. And I would like to know what you think about all that. You can, of course, email me or leave a comment on the blog or ring the comment line. And I may do this again where I talk about issues from time to time rather than just fluffing about as I normally do. But that is it for this episode of the Airman's Podcast, and that's it for this week. Have a great weekend, everybody, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye. You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Airman's Podcast at airmanspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, A-R-T-H-U-R, at airmanspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. listener line on 206-339-8413. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.